Skate on the Fabulous 413. There's a strike happening at Mass Mocha in North Adams, and we'll get an update on the situation with NEPM's Jill Kaufman.
And it's almost St. Patrick's Day, so we'll hear about all of the shiny new events and traditions returning to Holyoke St. Patrick's Day Parade with Committee President Haley Dunn.
But first, a recent article in the publication Nature about declining populations in the U.S. led to an article in Mass Live under the headline, "These 11 places in Massachusetts could be ghost towns by 2100. Research finds, which leads to our next three guests coming together and penning a response to those findings.
With us to talk about the prospect of those towns and declining populations are Democratic State Senator Joe Comerford from the Hampshire, Franklin, and Worcester District, Democratic State Representative Natalie Blay from the raging First Franklin District, and Independent State Rep Susanna Whips from the Second Franklin. There's no slack on being Second Franklin. It's just the order.
Why do you talk about the first one like they're a rugby team?
Well, I live there.
The raging
First Franklin District.
I think that's how you should identify yourself.
The Fighting First Franklin. I like that. I totally stole that from Colbert. He was gonna interview every representative in the entire country when he did the Colbert Report. And totally stole that from him. Anyway, there's an article in Mass Live in the Republican that was written by Dave Eisenstatter, who I invited to come on the show but didn't get back to me. And it begins with, "Could researchers more than 75 years ago have predicted the Massachusetts we live in today? It's a daunting task to look so far into the future, but one study is predicting that a number of Massachusetts communities could look like ghost towns by the year 2100. The study, published on January 11th in Nature and conducted by researchers at the University of Illinois at Chicago, found that half of the cities in the U.S. will face some sort of population decline in Massachusetts, about a dozen communities projected to lose a quarter or more of their population, according to these findings." Now, there was a retort that was also printed in Mass Live in the Republican, penned by our three guests. That begins...
"The problem with relying on past trends to predict the future is that they bank on the status quo in perpetuity. When a study predicts future population decline will decimate some of the rural Massachusetts communities that we represent by the year 2100, and when a media reports amplify these ghost town predictions, it's incumbent on all of us to not read this as gospel."
So we're here to dispel the gospel. No, it's too close to Easter to do that. But we do have state representatives Natalie Blay and Susanna Whips and State Senator Joe Comerford. Let's start with you, Natalie. The steepest declines it looked like could be in Franklin County, in Millers and in Northfield is what it seems. And I believe those are both of your districts. And it's interesting that, no, who's got Millers?
I have Millers.
Then we'll split it up. So, let's start with Northfield, because that's an actual town. So, is that what prompted you to want to join together in this response, Representative Whips?
Well, it isn't just one particular town. We really look at our districts as kind of a whole, and if one community is strong and successful, we see ripples throughout the neighboring communities, just as if there's a town experiencing difficulties, that often ripples as well. So it wasn't just one community. It was more, this is affecting all of our neighbors. So I wasn't looking particularly at just Northfield. I was looking at the ramifications of this across the district. And again, we're all so close.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And Northfield is, close to Montague, which features Millers Falls as one of its five villages, which you do represent, Natalie Blay. any idea why it's specifically poking at Millers as opposed to, say, any of the other five villages, and why it's dialed down into a village as opposed to a full town?
Yeah, so it is interesting, if you look at the whole list, that there are these small, small towns like Millers Falls, and there's Pittsfield on this list as well. And they did use something that's called census designated places for smaller communities that differ from fully incorporated towns, which is why Millers Falls is included in there. I do think that the author of the paper notes that this should serve as a wake-up call to policymakers. And I think that is something that we try to flag here. We have some very concrete steps that we've laid out in this response to say that we need to rethink the way that we do things, which is what the author of the paper said, that he also notes it's an opportunity to be more creative. I will note that Justin Hollander is also quoted in the article from Tufts University, who says that making specific projections this far in advance is, quote, pretty reckless given the amount of uncertainty that the future holds. So while this is important research, it should not be viewed as determinative of what is going to happen for us. And we can take steps to make sure that we don't see these sorts of population declines.
Yeah, the first thing that I thought when I heard about this article was that's a long ways in the future to be assuming that the surface of the Earth is still going to be livable.
Yeah. And they do take climate change into account into this study.
I read a lot of sci-fi, so like I just go to the end game there. But one of the parallels between both your article and the original article is a focus on infrastructure and how important it is to kind of bolster that in some of these communities and kind of across the board because the system has been so weakened and undermined. Can we talk about some of the infrastructure? Well, I don't want to jump straight to your 11 points. Is it okay to
There's 11 points, so we're kind of going to take some time to get. We'll get to some of them.
Can we talk about some of the infrastructure things that you outline in these 11 points that you brought up?
Let's give this one to Senator Joe Comerford.
Sure, and thanks for talking about this on your important show, because, you know, I know that Rep. Whips and Rep. Lay and I felt very passionately when we saw this article. You know, before we get to infrastructure, I think we'd all want to have the listeners understand that conversations about population decline in Franklin County and other rural regions are not new. We've lost people over even the 5 years that the three of us have been together in office. Rep. Whips precedes us, but in the 5 years that Natalie, Susanna, and I have been in office, we've lost population. And that has a lot to do, you're right, with infrastructure. And I will say an unequitable investment in rural communities, leaving us disadvantaged and really vulnerable to population decline because of lack of employment, lack of ability to get around, lack of housing, lack of access to education, equitable education. And so these are all, you know, essentially infrastructure that we have to build here. And that's what the article is meaning to say, right? Five of the 11 communities I represent in partnership with Rep. Whips and Rep. Lay. And man, that made me mad as a hornet to see these projections into the future when we know darn well what we have to do in Massachusetts to help our communities thrive. And we're just not yet getting to it. Although I will say the Healy-Driscoll administration's made the best go we've ever seen. Yep. In my lifetime in Massachusetts, they've made the best go at recognizing the unique opportunities and challenges of rural communities. But we know what to do to thwart this. We have to find the social and political will to get it done.
Do you think, Senator Joe Comerford, that it is infrastructure that has caused the population decline in the time that you have been there? Or is it something else that is causing this population decline? Something that might not be anything that one could predict 75 years into the future?
Right. I wish I had a crystal ball, Monty. You know, I wish I could say this is the exact combination of issues. But when Rep. Whips and Rep. Lay and I looked at the things that we were working on and that we cared about and that we heard from constituents and towns, the 11, we could have written more, but 11 communities, you know, are losing population, 11 answers seemed quite poetic.
Yes.
So we could have, as everybody said, written more, but these are the top ones that really rise all the time to give our communities challenges, to give our people challenges, and that's why we put them on the list for consideration, both of the members in our own delegations in the House and the Senate, but also the administration. And to its credit, again, the administration and our colleagues are tuning in.
When I look at this list that's printed in MassLive and by my friend Dave Eisenstetter, who wrote this article, you know, Millers and Northfield, as we mentioned, are top of the list, loss of 48% of their population predicted by 2100. Then there are places like East Dennis on the Cape and Chatham on the Cape that I'm assuming by 2100 could be underwater. So, I mean, and as well as areas surrounding Boston, who's to say that those people wouldn't want to migrate west? What's your take on the idea, even during the pandemic, when everything was shut down in the city, so many people were trying to buy land in rural areas and scooped up the entire housing market. What's your take on that, Representative Susanna Whips?
I think you've hit the nail on the head that, and one of the reasons people were able to move out to this area is the work that we've done. And prior to me, Steve Kulik and Paul Mark, to get broadband to these communities, or people wouldn't have been able to or wanted to come. So we have worked really hard to make coming to these communities more attractive. Also, prior to COVID, we screamed for years about telemedicine and how important telehealth care could be to rural communities. So we learned during COVID that it's possible to do that. So I think there's a lot of positives to moving out here. Right now, our biggest concern is there's nowhere for people to move to. And one of the things, and again, we all have this manifesto of 11 things are all pieces that we all have talked about and fought about and, you know, fought to get attention to. And my thing right now is senior housing. We've got so many seniors, and we're in the midst of the silver tsunami. All of the folks are leaving the workforce and the boomers are retiring. They're in homes that they raise their families. Oftentimes the homes become too expensive. They're not accessible to the needs of an elder. There's nowhere for them to go and age in place. And they will take the burden of a house that's not accessible and a house that's very expensive over leaving their friends and their church families and the communities they live in. If we're able to build some adequate, affordable, accessible senior housing, we'll have the opportunity to open up these beautiful homes for young families to come, which will address our declining enrollment in schools and also build our local workforce, which is something we need to look at as well. So I think senior housing is something that would have incredible ripple effects across the region.
Well, that is one of the 11 ways to defy the Western Mass ghost towns of future prediction in the Viewpoint that's written by our three guests, Representatives Natalie Blay and Susanna Whips and State Senator Joe Comerford. We'll take a little break and we'll run down some more of this 11-point plan coming up in just a minute.
You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
Welcome back to the Fabulous 413. We are joined by State Senator Joe Comerford and State Representatives Natalie Blay and Susanna Whips, who wrote an opinion piece called 11 Ways to Defy the Western Mass Ghost Towns of the Future Prediction that was based on a report earlier this year and written about in Mass Live and the Republican by Dave Eisenstadter, listing some communities that may face this by the year 2100. The three representatives on Beacon Hill have an 11-point plan that they spell out in this article. We talked a little bit about point number one, which is turbocharging the housing development in rural communities. And there's no way we'll get to all of them, but let's combine some of these. Part number two
and three work together. It's public transportation.
Yeah, regional rail and public transportation. Why don't we give that one to you, Representative Natalie Blay?
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, I think that we have tremendous opportunities when it comes to transportation in the region. We've seen growth in what we have available in terms of rail with the Berkshire Flyer, with the Valley Flyer, with East-West Rail finally coming to fruition, and the possibility for Route 2 rail along the Route 2 corridor, the northern tier. So when you look at that as a system and the sort of economic development that those trains can drive, it is really, really exciting. And we have been fighting for a very long time for increased investment in our regional transit authorities. And we've got some great news there. We have been able to deliver in terms of additional funding for our regional transit authorities, like the FRTA, like the PVTA. RTAs serve over 250 communities beyond the reach of the MBTA. They are critically important for so many communities. We've been able to increase the funding available to them. And now RTAs like the FRTA are for the very first time serving residents on evenings and weekends, which it's just so critically important for economic mobility and connections.
It's huge in Franklin County. It has not been the case.
And I think people don't necessarily understand that having both of those things together actually decreases the taxing on the system of having just one or the other. Like, having that synergy actually brings in more people and allows those systems to work independently much better. Let's move on to the school question.
Yeah. Who wants to address the question of what investment in the schools and higher ed both together would be? You want to take that one, Senator Joe?
Sure. Happy to. I'm happy to have my colleagues jump in. So we have both public higher education and K-12 and also early ed listed in different buckets as real game changers. Let's start quickly, and I'll run through them. And again, Rep. Lay and Rep. Whips, chime in. Early ed. The governor would like to really double down her investment on early education. We've seen some of the benefits for that, not all, but some in Western Massachusetts of previous investment, thanks to fair share revenue. I'm a little concerned, I'll speak only for myself, that the governor's current proposal prioritizes gateway cities, and I don't like that. I want equitable prioritization so that some of our rural communities can benefit from a new venture that's looking to expand early education and care to universal. I support universal care. I want it for small communities. It's a workforce game changer. When it comes to K-12 schools, all the districts I represent are either classified as rural schools or what is called minimum aid schools. Now, we don't have enough time to go as deep into the weeds on these two issues, these two buckets of schools categorizations as we'd want to, but basically what it means is that our schools have declining enrollment and they are not getting enough money because we have fewer and fewer students to be able to maintain operating costs. And that means that we risk an inequitable access to education for our kids in Western Massachusetts. We can change that. And the Joint Committee on Ways and Means was just at Greenfield Community College for one of its oversight hearings. And the report was pretty unequivocal, both about the problem that these districts are facing and also the call to action, which I believe has to be a reopening of what's called Chapter 70 or our school formula, so that we can really see the benefits equitably wrought across the Commonwealth. And the third bucket is, of course, public higher education. We are rich in educational institutions, public and private, in Western Massachusetts. But if we just talk about the public's investment in the public sector, the public higher education sector, there's a lot of good news there. Rep. Whips and Rep. Blay have been talking about other pieces of good news. We've managed in the legislature to reduce tuition and fees considerably. So right now in the Commonwealth, if you're Pell eligible and you attend a four-year institution, you're going for free. Books and supplies, tuition and fees, and a little stipend, all for free. If you're a little bit higher than that, your tuition could get cut in half. And then if you're over 25 or if you're a nursing student at a community college, you're going for free at community colleges. So that's massive game changer. And we've invested in our infrastructure, that's buildings and the kind of workspaces that we need. And why do we do that? Well, we want it for our students. We don't want them to be burdened by debt, but we also need them to both go to these campuses because they're going to disproportionately return and live their lives in Massachusetts. And we need their skills. We need them to have excellent, excellent preparation because they're the leaders of the future. They're gonna raise families and start businesses and become teachers and lawyers and writers. Who knows, you know, they could become NEPM broadcasters.
No.
And we need them to be well prepared. And it's a virtuous cycle. Education creates a virtuous cycle for us from birth up to college, and then a virtuous cycle for the workforce. We need small businesses, large businesses to know that when they locate in Western Massachusetts, they're gonna get really well-trained employees. And we need to strengthen that employer education bond so that they can know what the students are being prepared for. Anyway, you can tell I can go on, but it's an essential good.
That rolls into, I think, like the last point we'll be able to make, which is your 11th point in making rural an economic sector. I think your points 8 and 9 roll into this really nicely, but what does that actually look like? What does rural look like as an economic sector?
Let's give the last word to Representative Natalie Blay, because Representative Susanna Whips turned into there you are again. You turned into an icon on my computer, but let's go with Natalie Blay anyway, and then you can add if you need to, Representative Whips.
I appreciate that. So, you know, I think that this, as Senator Comerford noted, this administration has made tremendous strides when it comes to recognizing the importance of rural communities in our Commonwealth. One of the very first actions that Governor Healey took was to establish a director of rural affairs. And let me tell you, former Senator Ann Gobey has hit the ground running and is doing tremendous, tremendous work alongside all of us in support of the 181 rural communities in the Commonwealth. And I will say, in recognition of the work of this administration, Senator Comerford and I were at another Ways and Means hearing with the Secretary of Economic Development, who had this article bookmarked on her phone. So this has resonated far and wide. Each one of these points has resonated across the Commonwealth. And we're really hoping that it will make the Commonwealth develop a thoughtful growth management strategy that really identifies some solutions here for these communities.
Representative Whips, in the 30 seconds we have left, what is working?
We're working with our colleagues, with our municipal officials, with our local folks who are getting up every day and going to work. We're working with our business owners. We're listening. We're joining forces with our other colleagues. You know, 20% of the people live in 80% of the landmass out here in this part of the state. And it's really important that we, as a Western Mass delegation, join forces and make sure we have loud, big, booming voices down there in Boston and continue to remind them that their water comes from us.
That's
right.
That
our trees are breathing for them, that our food is coming from our farmers, and the contribution that Western Mass makes to the entire Commonwealth is huge, and we need to be compensated for it.
Representative Susanna Whips, Representative Natalie Blay, and Senator Joe Comerford, in their opinion piece in Mass Live and the Republican, 11 Ways to Defy the Western Mass Ghost Towns of the Future Prediction. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for taking the time.
Sure.
Thanks, Monty. Thanks,
our pleasure.
Coming up, an update with the ongoing strike of UAW workers at Massmoca with NEPM's Jill Kaufman, and that was a lot of acronyms.
And all the green Paper City can handle as we hear about Holyoke St. Patrick's Day Parade with Committee President Haley Dunn.
You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
The Fabulous 413 podcast is funded by Northeast Solar, homegrown in Hatfield, Massachusetts, and providing energy savings for their customers for over 10 years. Learn more at northeast-solar.com.
Welcome back to the Fabulous 413. I'm Monty Belmonte.
And I'm Clee Smith. Holyoke's 71st St. Patrick's Day Parade will happen this Sunday. What began as a humble celebration so many years ago has grown into a major series of events that culminates with New England's preeminent St. Patrick's Celebration. Along with the Mardi Gras, the Rose Parade, and other national treasures, the Holyoke St. Patrick's Day Parade has been designated a local legacy by the Library of Congress.
That's so cool.
I know, right?
There's much more to the festivities than the pomp of the day of the parade, and here to talk about that is the committee president, Haley Dunn, who is also the manager of corporate citizenship at Eversource, where she manages the company's philanthropy and volunteer activities and the Eversource Foundation.
A native of Western Massachusetts, she was honored in the parade as the parade's Rohan Award recipient in 2018, an award given by the committee to a member who has made significant contributions to the overall success of the parade. Prior to becoming president of the committee, Haley served as committee spokeswoman and served as one of the hosts for the parade's television broadcast.
Hey, I've done that. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you for taking some time out, because your event is happening like literally Saturday and Sunday. You must be so busy.
Oh, we are swamped. Last minute details, getting ready for the weekend. But you know what? We're really excited. It's going to be a wonderful weekend in Holyoke.
Tell us about the road race. When and where is that happening?
Oh, the road race, the spectacular Holyoke St. Patrick's Road Race, the famed 10K road race. It could be very challenging. Unfortunately, I can't say that I've actually run it, but
You've just figuratively run it as the head of the committee.
Correct. But looking forward to a great weekend. So the road race will kick off right at 1 o'clock, but come down there beforehand. We've got the Kids Fun Run at 11 a.m. We've got a presentation where we're going to present the JFK Award recipient, Mike Gorman, with an award, and we're going to have a celebration for him with some entertainment on the street around noon, right before the race. And then, of course, a kickoff is right at 1, but you know it doesn't end at the road race. We got a big block party, lots of entertainment, food trucks, vendors, you know, bars that are ready for thousands and thousands of people. So it's going to be a great time.
How many awards are now part of the weekend's festivities? Because I don't think it started with as many awards as there are now.
That's correct. So we're 71 years going strong, as you mentioned. And so we did start the parade with our annual National Award recipient, which was since renamed the JFK Award after, of course, President Kennedy. So we've had a national award, 70 plus years. We've had the Grand Marshal. But about 30 years ago, we introduced the Ambassador Award. And this isn't a really an important award. We do it in concert with the Irish Consul General's Office in Boston. And it's given to an individual who has helped promote the relations between the Republic of Ireland and the United States. So we've had, folks from philanthropy and media and in lots of different other fields who have been presented with this award. And this year, we're welcoming Dr. Catherine Shannon, who is a professor of a retired professor of Irish history to Western Massachusetts. And we're going to present her with that award as well. But then, of course, we have our committee awards as well. But, lots of people to recognize. We have a citizenship award recipient. It's given to, although it's a Holyoke St. Patrick's parade, we do have the citizenship award, which is given to an individual who may not be of Irish descent, but who has helped to promote the parade and in our associated events.
Very cool. We are speaking with the head of the Holyoke St. Patrick's Day Committee, Haley Dunn. And you mentioned the JFK Award winner, Mike Gorman, which some people will recognize that name instantly. And being in a basketball city like Springfield, tell us a little bit about Mike Gordon and the decision to give Gorman, not Gordon.
Gorman.
That would be the guy from Fish.
Yes.
The JFK award winning, the JFK award.
Yeah, we are very excited to have Mike Gorman here in Holyoke this coming weekend.
I should say he is the play-by-play guy for the Boston
he
Celtics.
He is. Yes. So Mike is
the most
is certainly
Irish of basketball teams in the NBA.
I mean, could it be any better, right? Could we have gotten anybody better? And not only that, this is his, he's retiring at the end of this year.
Oh.
So it's very fitting in so many different ways. Where we're honoring Mike for his career, his, 40-plus years with the Boston Celtics as the play-by-play. He's a veteran. He just embodies so much of what's great about the JFK National Award. And so he's coming in this weekend. He's bringing his family. He's going to be here Friday evening. He's going to be down at the road race. And then, of course, culminating in the parade and marching and the parade on Sunday. But, we've had some fabulous former award recipients. The ambassador to Ireland, Dan Rooney. We've had Maureen O'Hara, the beautiful and former actress. We've had Team Hoyt, the father-son duo, the famous running duo. Just phenomenal names, and we're very honored to add Mike Gorman to that name of illustrious award recipients.
How has the parade changed over the years that you've been involved with the committee, not just in your years as president, but like we had a pandemic in the middle, which definitely changed some things, and the organizations and events always grow. So what's different about this year that you didn't necessarily see in your first years on the committee?
That's an excellent question. And, I've been a member for about 15 years now, and funny, when I ran to become second vice president, it was 2019, thinking I was going to be president in 2022, but then we had COVID happen. So that set everybody back a few years, but it also allowed us time to kind of rethink our events and how we present our events and certainly sponsorships. Our parade, it's not free. It costs a lot to put the parade and our associated events down the street. So we've come up with interesting packages for our sponsors. We've invited new entertainment and new units to be a part of our parade. This year, we're really excited. We have a couple new features, going on the theme of, The Voice and others. We're having the People's Choice Award. So every year we do have bands and floats that get judged and they get presented with a trophy and another gift. This year we're putting it to the people and offering the People's Choice Award. So as people are watching the parade, either on the street or on the television broadcast, on 22 News or online, they can vote for their favorite bands as they see it. And they can vote as many times. And so it's just, an
opportunity. It's like Irish Idol.
Monty, why didn't we go to you
first? Come to me next time.
Next year we're gonna call it the Irish Idol. But it's just an opportunity to give our bands that keep coming back year after year and the new bands. We do have some new bands coming in this year that we're very excited about, to give them bragging rights. And so that's something that we're really excited to introduce. The other thing is, parking. You know, we want to bring as many people into downtown Holyoke as possible for the road race and the parade. So this year, we're delighted that the city of Holyoke has partnered with MGM, and we're allowing free shuttle service Saturday and Sunday between 10 and 3:30. Every half hour, you can park at MGM and get a ride into downtown Holyoke, enjoy the festivities, enjoy the parade, and then, you know, get back, you know, to your car at the MGM parking garage. So just finding a new opportunity, ways to engage our fans and to bring people into downtown Holyoke.
It is this Sunday on St. Patrick's Day. It was awesome. 11:10 kickoff. I'm assuming that has to do with television on Northampton Street in Holyoke.
It does.
And ends on High Street. Thank you so much for coming in, Committee President of the Holyoke St. Patrick's Day Parade, Haley Dunn.
Thank you so much.
Good luck with all of the running you're doing. You say you're not running a 10K, but like I know,
like, sounds like it.
You're probably going to do at least that much
sure.
distance.
Sure,
check your
will.
Pedometer when you're done.
Coming up, what's the latest with the strike at Massapequa and North Adams? NEPM reporter Jill Kaufman will give us the lowdown next.
You're listening to the Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM. Oh. Welcome back to the Fabulous 413. The strike of union workers at Massapequa has dragged on for almost a week. They are asking for what they call a fair minimum wage for workers of $18.25 an hour. The museum is offering a dollar less. Negotiations had been going on for several months before the strike began last week.
NEPM's Jill Kaufman was in North Adams yesterday speaking with people who were picketing and with some business owners who are feeling the impact of what's happening right now on the Massapequa campus. Betsy, do we have a clip of the striking workers right there on the line? Oh, somewhere we do. We'll find that later. But Jill, tell us what the latest is with the strike.
Well, hello.
Hi.
Do you want to talk about why you just played Laurie Anderson?
I should, because the Laurie Anderson exhibit is one of the ones that I believe is closed.
Yes.
Or two of her exhibits
yes.
are closed at Massapequa. She's an artist sort of in residence there.
Yes.
First of all, I mean, I'm not going to glow about the exhibits now. We're talking about the strike.
Let's talk about the strike. The museum is open. Two exhibits are closed, like you said. There is the latest. An hour ago, there were no negotiations underway. So that means that the museum has not reached out to the union, and the union has not reached out to the museum. The union says the ball is in the museum's court. They made the last counteroffer. This is, you know, according to sides, there's a lot of black and white here, which, mm-hmm. you know, is just the way strikes work. Negotiations had been going on for a couple months, as you said, 4 months, actually. There's 120 union workers on strike, and they are rotating now on the picket line, 7-day-a-week picket line. Tomorrow is a full week.
Mm-hmm. It'll be a full week of picketing. So who was in that? That's 120 is rotating. Who's out there on the picket line? And they're talking about wages. Are they giving up the wages while they are on strike, or how is it working?
They are giving up their pay. They are not giving up their benefits. Massapequa is still paying benefits and still contributing to retirement funds. So about 60%. So let's just say that's over 60 people are those people who are making that minimum wage right now, which mm-hmm. is $16.25 an hour. They are out there on the line, but also people who are electricians, people who are artist fabricators who work with artists to help build the larger installations. They're out there. The union representatives are out there as well. I spoke with one woman. This is her retirement job. She is not worried about the money that she makes, but she is out there. Yesterday, cold, snowy day, very cold, very windy. You'll hear a lot of wind once we start hearing these folks. But, you know, let's hear from Joey Raynon is Massapequa's production master electrician. He does all the lighting for the shows at Massapequa, so all those wonderful summer events in particular we think of when we think of on a cold day. He is part of the local UAW. He's not in an electrician's union. He is a union delegate. He makes a higher salary than that minimum wage, right? But he says he's out there because he believes in fair wages.
I think the tricky thing is like it's an ethics issue, so it's always going to be a relatively gray area for a lot of people. I think the big things to consider is that, like, all of us are human beings. The people we're negotiated with are human beings. They are people that are emotionally invested in the institution as well. I just don't necessarily think that they're in touch with people that are in lower tax brackets than them. I don't think they understand the reality of, like, living in a town that is rapidly gentrifying because of the museum and then, like, losing my apartment because they're turning it into an Airbnb.
You know, the strike, it's not happening in an isolated sense. I mean, North Adams was supposed to benefit so greatly from the development of Mass Mocha. It's been there, you know, it's been there more than two decades now. And North Adams is still economically depressed, but you've got like what happened in the pandemic with rentals, and in a place where there's so much beauty and fun, people are, you know, are having, there's higher rents, there's these Airbnb situation where there's not enough rentals. So what, you know, Joey Raynon is talking about is not just what he's not getting from the museum, what museum workers aren't getting, but that the cost of living, you know, is just shifted in ways that nobody expected in a town that was supposed to do better because, you know, feel economically better because of the museum being there.
And yeah. That's a little ironic considering what's happened to the other arts communities of Western Mass, where this is like this is being mirrored. Like you have that in Northampton, you have that in East Hampton, like where people are just artists are being priced out. You bring the art in, people want to see the art, but they don't necessarily want to provide housing that's affordable by artists. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting because there are pockets of North Adams that are doing better because of this. About, you know, he mentioned Airbnb, so I'm sure if, like, real estate owners are doing somewhat better if they would like to be. But there are also businesses on campus at Mass Mocha that are directly affected by this strike. Mm-hmm. And you talked to a few of those business owners.
I did. I spoke to Xavier Jones yesterday. He is the owner of Big Daddy's Philly Steakhouse. So this is the building that is right on the edge of the parking lot on the campus.
It used to be A-OK Barbecue.
It did. Both really smelling good places. I did not buy lunch yesterday there.
I really missed out.
That's real journalists do.
Yeah, that's what the real. We didn't buy, and I didn't get a beer either. Just want to say that across the way. So
Bright Ideas Brewing, shameless plug.
I could have used one. So Xavier Jones was sitting there on a chair next to a couple of workers and was just looking down. And I mean, he was. I don't want to read into this. He was miserable. He said, you know, people are not coming by. Usually people come in from the community. If you work in town, you get lunch there. He said people are not coming in. I'm assuming he meant because they don't want to cross a picket line. And he's had to cut back on staff hours at this point.
I'm worried about my staff. I'm worried about whether I can keep them employed because of this. I am annoyed that I am stuck in a crossfire. I am annoyed that I am losing business because of other people's business. This is not direct towards me, but because I'm on the property of where it's being directed, I'm being affected.
One of the other business owners that you talked to is from the family that owns Lickety Split, which is literally inside the museum. Mm-hmm. What was your conversation
so
with that?
I spoke to Danielle Rollis. She left home, went to college, came back, and decided to work in the family business. They've owned this business for 25 years. Mm-hmm. They are also seeing huge drop in the number of customers. She was very careful to be balancing that, you know, museum staff and management are coming to get their coffees. People who are picketing are coming in to get their coffees. But they have lost money. They're deciding what to do. They're trying to keep their staff on. They're cutting out on other things like purchases, and they're still figuring it out.
We're talking what orders can we not put in so that we can pay our staff. And that's just very transparent. But that's the position that we're in. And so it's a little jarring because we haven't felt that since, I want to say, you know, COVID hit. So, yeah, I think it's been tough. And
that's Danielle Reyes, the owner of Lickety Split. The museum is open, but before we let you go, Jill Kaufman, there is a giant cautionary tale, Scabby the Rat, that is out in front.
That's what that was, yeah. Scabby the Rat was getting blown around in that wind.
It's an inflatable giant rat.
There's a few people who did not vote to strike. They are inside working. It's not clear how many. I asked how many people were. I know that we have to wrap it up, but I just want to say that. So people who are striking are getting $500 a week from the union. That's the UAW is a big union. Your dues go to that. It is an endless pot at this point. So they could stay out there. For some people, if they are part-time, that was more than their wages, I was told. And I'm just struck by how much people love working at the museum and that the place really has an important role in the city, but that there's a great divergence. I'm surprised that there is nobody negotiating at this point.
The museum didn't say anything about what that $1 actually does on their end?
The museum said it was their largest offer, its highest wage in its history, and it was a 3.5% across-the-board salary increase overall. So other people were getting salary increases as well. So we start off at $16.25. The union wanted... The museum offered less than it's offering now at $17.25. The museum wanted more than what it's asking for at $18.25. It is, according to the workers, $150,000 a year more out of the budget for Mass Mocha. you know, people are pointing fingers at high-paid, you know, executive directors and folks who are making different salaries. But, you know, it's a lot of he said, she said right now, and a lot of people want to get back to work.
We'll be following this story. Thank you, NEPM News Department's Jill Kaufman. A big thank you to Candace in Ludlow and Donna in Southbury for making a contribution during this fund drive.
You're fundraising?
Yes. And tomorrow on the Fabulous 413, we're going to learn how to play the bagpipes.
It's awesome.
And we'll also talk to Las Cafeteras, and we'll have the word nerd. I'm Monty Belmonte.
I'm Khalees Smith. We'll see you tomorrow on the Fabulous 413. Loudly. Big city.